The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
About the treatment of bullet wounds in the South African war. It required patience, hydrogen peroxide and tweezers to extract uniform threads, which had entered the flesh in company with the bullet. "Do not forget," said the colonel, "that the bullet is not a sterile instrument. It's been loaded by an almost certainly filthy hand, perhaps by a disease-ridden one. When it strikes the victim, it introduces dirt.
The first patient I visited was a wool merchant named Mr. Percival Maybury, whose one great affliction was his abiding constipation. And because all his thoughts turned day by day upon the making of a good stool to relieve the pain in his bowel, his wool business was neglected and going down towards ruin. He'd grown very thin.
Hospitals, supposedly places where the science of medicine is practiced on our bodies. But of course, we're not machines any more than medicine is purely mechanical. It also involves so many social issues, and hospitals, enclosed institutions, even on the battlefield, heighten our emotions and sharpen our perception of relationships. So Thomas Keneally discovered when he started to read the journals of Australian nurses who went out to serve in the First World War. It was these diaries that inspired his latest novel, The Daughters of Mars, set in the field hospitals of the Dardanelles and the Western Front. Of course, Keneally's best known for his prize-winning Schindler's List. Sarah Crown began by asking him why he was so fascinated by war.
It's very perverse appeal. I think it's because it's such an extreme condition for humanity that it actually fascinates pacifists more than it does martial types. And, of course, the great irony is, I'm sure Pat Barker and Sebastian Foulkes and all those people are pacifists, and yet they can't leave war alone. And, again, I think the question arises about one's own courage at a primal level. Blokes want to be courageous. I've seen war destroy men. When I was a little kid in the suburbs of Sydney, I saw the men come home from New Guinea and other places, and including my father, and nothing was ever the same again. It wasn't the same.
So?
A lot of them had psychiatric and drinking problems. And on top of that, the woman had run the children and the household for a number of years. And now the husband, inevitably, particularly of that generation, thought that she'd run it in a particularly feminine way that was bad for the boys, you know, didn't toughen up the boys enough. And there were plentiful conflicts of that nature. I'm amazed by World War I. I had an uncle involved. I possess his letters. But I'm particularly fascinated by the path women took then, because if women find there's a patriarchy now, the patriarchy then was an unself-doubting patriarchy, and women accepted that men were the supergender. the struggle the women had to establish status in itself is a great story. It is, at the risk of sounding glib, it's a feminist struggle that they undertook. These Australian girls, young women who had no status. The medical side fascinated me. The young women at the casualty clearing stations would receive every few days a convoy of ambulances. They would try to turn them round within 2 days, send them to base hospitals, or some would have died and would be buried. Girls from remote municipalities in Australia, townships that had existed for perhaps 80 years, girls therefore of limited background, were dealing with this tsunami of damaged young men concentrated into a particular age group, a very defined age group, about 17 to, say, 27, of such severity that one would encounter it only occasionally in civilian nursing. Mm. And I'm fascinated by the way they held that together. And I've said a few times, it reminds me now of the way Aboriginal women are holding communities together. You know, men feel their dispossession and they feel their dislocation, and it often brutalizes them, makes them turn to drink, etc., etc. And the women hold the fort.
And the other thing that you mentioned was of what happens afterwards, the kind of the aftermath of war, which again is a great deal of what this book is about. It's sort of, I guess, in a sense, the scaffolding of the war. You know, the stagehands who are there allowing the performance of the war to take place, and that's
yes.
what these women are.
These people, the doctors and nurses, were the ones who got the read out of damage from the trenches. Mm. This is not in the trenches. This is in the huts and tents of the casualty clearing station. And in base hospitals such as the Australian Voluntary Hospital run by Lady Tarleton, which was a hospital that actually existed. There was an English woman named Lady Dudley who'd been in Australia and who founded an Australian Voluntary Hospital at Boulogne, and she was too good to pass up. Therefore, a lot of this book is about women asserting themselves in nearly impossible conditions of assertion.
So tell us a little bit about the research then, because obviously you write non-fiction books of history as well. Does the same amount of research go into a novel about history as does into a piece of non-fiction?
In this case, yes. I was attracted by the journals of the nurses that I started to read. I got some printed off from the Australian War Memorial, and a number have been published in small ways. We have had a lot of writing in Australia, as I'm sure you have here, about the war after the war, that is, the men who died in the shadow of the war between 1918 and, say, 1931, between the coming of the peace and the onset of the Depression. I have a series of letters from an uncle called Johnny Keneally, who came from the same town as these girls and who enlisted in the AAF and served 2 years in France. He arrived as a reinforcement early in 1916. So he's here 2.5 years. A lot of the style of this book, the dashes, the lack of, in inverted commas and so on, is based on the way the nurses and my uncle Johnny wrote. What is interesting about that period of history, it was the end of the period when, after a hard day's exploration, British or Australian or Canadian explorers would sit down and write an elegant entry into a journal. And it was the age of the journal, and ordinary people, ordinary soldiers, felt that they must keep a journal of these extraordinary circumstances. Many of the nurses kept such a journal, thank God.
One point at which Sally is writing a letter back to her father, who's still in Australia, what she produces is this incredibly vivid description. And I wondered when I was reading that whether that was drawn from a real source or just something of your own creation.
Yes, it is drawn from a letter, particularly the writing about Egypt. Mm-hmm. The problem still exists of that you see a face from another culture and it's very hard to penetrate that face, to imagine what life is inside that face. And this is something that Sally, the younger sister, thinks a lot about a lot, particularly in Egypt. I think she looks at an Egyptian woman and thinks, what are you thinking, Mrs. Egypt? Or what are you doing today, Mrs. Egypt?
This is, I think, your 29th novel, which is pretty good going. Do you have any plans for the 30th?
Yes, I've got another novel written. When I was a little kid in 1944, an extraordinary thing happened in Western New South Wales. And you didn't have hordes of young Scandinavians and Germans and so on wandering along our bush tracks. In 1944, 1,000 young Japanese prisoners in a camp on the edge of a typical Western New South Wales town named Cowra were driven by, catalyzed by events, into immolating themselves against the wire, into charging Australian machine guns, scaling three walls of wire. They were aware that their funeral services had been held back in Japan, and they wanted to validate them. They felt the shame of prisonerhood. And down in the town are many young women, like one of the main characters, Alice, whose husband has been a POW from Crete. There is, again, this cultural gulf between what's going on in the minds of these young Japanese men. There is one day when six of them who are troublemakers are forced to work on the dirt road outside her property. And because her husband's a prisoner of war, she is obscurely driven to make them lemonade. It's a frying Australian day. And she makes them lemonade and takes it out to them. And she studies their faces as if by studying them she can find out something about the destiny of her own husband. And then, as in Britain, there were Italian POWs, and the ones who weren't hardcore fascists were let out to work on farms. And in those days, Australia was white Australia, and even southern Italians were looked at askance. And the proposition was no decent Australian girl would want to look at a greasy Italian. Well, the question arises, what if the Italian looks like Marcello Mastroianni? And so there were many romances on the farms. Well, that's what I've tried to write about.
Sounds absolutely fascinating, and a really.
But of course, we've got to have Alice has to fall for her Italian.
Yeah.
That is certain, because you've.
Good looking Italian.
Yes. One of the most touching aspects is that there was a female impersonator, Japanese female impersonator, in Kara camp. Before the war, he had been a balladist and female impersonator professionally. And so increasingly, he just wears drag. And when it's time to charge the wire, he charges the wire in drag.
And this is all taken from the historical record?
Well, yes. With the great thing about novels is that you can stretch the truth and tell lies. I mean, fiction is a synonym for lie. So in fiction, you try to tell the truth by telling lies. And in history, you try to tell the truth by trying to tell the truth.
Thomas Keneally telling some home truths there in his inimitable way. The Daughters of Mars is published by Scepter. Though his novel isn't coy about the gruesome details of war nursing, Keneally is more interested in the psychology of his characters than in the medicine and science they're practicing to help their patients. Sarah Wise takes us into the science of the mind, as it was practiced half a century earlier in the 19th century. Her book is called Inconvenient People, Lunacy, Liberty and the Mad Doctors in Victorian England, and it collects up some really quite mind-boggling stories. She told Sarah Crown what she means by inconvenient people.
My inconvenient people, there are about a dozen of them, and the real reason they're inconvenient, most of them weren't remotely batty, but they weren't eccentric. But the real reason they were inconvenient is because they were just too rich, and people around them really wanted to grab a hold of their money or control of their estate. Each of these people faced an attempt to get them certified as a lunatic by two separate doctors and placed into private asylums, where, of course, the proprietor is extremely interested in you continuing to be described as insane, because, of course, he continues to pocket the fees. There's nothing in it for him for you to either get well if you are ill or to be proved sane if you are sane. I was actually writing something else altogether, researching something else altogether, and then I went to the theatre and I saw a production of Gaslight by Patrick Hamilton, written in 1938 but set towards the end of the 19th century, in which a very unpleasant Victorian paterfamilias attempts to make his very highly strung but completely sane wife push her over the edge so that he can have her certified, make off with her money and his mistress. And sitting there in the theatre, which was absolutely packed out, I thought, why do we not need to have this explained to us? There's no historical background beforehand. The programme notes don't go into it. Oh, Victorian men could easily do this to their wives. And so I just suddenly thought, well, could they? And what was the mechanism by which they did it? Surely it would require high levels of complicity amongst doctors and asylum superintendents. How easy was it to pull off? And how often was it tried in real life? And also, I wondered, was it always one-way traffic? Was it always men doing it to their wives or their errant daughters? And so I started digging around in the archives and 19th century newspapers and periodicals. And what struck me very quickly was the number of men who were being put into asylums, private asylums, under highly questionable circumstances, and about whom the newspapers were beginning to kick up a fuss.
Mm. Yeah, because we view it culturally as a facet of the gender conflict, don't we? And certainly that's how it's represented in popular culture. And I can remember being at university and reading Elaine Showalter's book, The Female Malady.
Yes, I did.
And thinking, this is terrible. This is about the Matrimonial Causes Act, and this is about suppressing women. But what you found was that that wasn't the case at all.
It looks very much of a piece with all the other completely genuine civil and legal disabilities that married women faced. Mm-hmm. I mean, the problem was that once a Victorian woman married, she no longer had a separate legal identity. Therefore, she could take no civil actions, couldn't enter into any form of contract. All her property automatically became her husband's unless she had had the equivalent of what we call a prenup now, which many wealthy women did do, but the majority didn't. And so one of the things that really astonished me during the research was the fact that the lunacy laws were sort of gender blind, actually, and that a certain number of women were using them, wives, I mean, were using them to get rid of and to silence, to put away, to nullify drunken and violent or extremely uncongenial husbands. Mm. Now, that sounds potty because it looks like women using the medical system and a legal system in a way that we don't expect them to. But the thing to bear in mind is an awful lot of these doctors will have had an evangelical bent. And evangelicals completely believed in the dominance of male over female, but male authority was natural and God-given. And the minute a man raised his hand to his wife or his children, he was giving up his true sense of dominance. And the word that you see throughout a lot of these cases is unmanly. And what unmanly means is violent and irrational. So there was a, if you got the right doctor, and many women found the right doctor, you could go to him with a case that your husband isn't just a drunk. He's drunk himself into delirium tremens. He's extremely violent. You're very frightened. So are the children. And you do see this repeatedly. And many of the men who went into the asylums were not insane. They were drunks. And the minute they dried out, they were able to mount their campaign to get free. Mm-hmm. And so you see those cases cropping up repeatedly. And that really surprised me, the fact that one of the few weapons a wife could have against domestic violence were in fact the lunacy laws.
Yeah. What it does seem to show is an absolute faith in and adherence to the legal system. And that being the levelling thing, the thing that everyone could sort of commit to, was that...
That's exactly right. And the other thing that struck me was, if you wanted to very fiercely cherry-pick your history, you could actually write a book that said that only men, or mainly men, were put away in questionable circumstances because their behaviour wasn't deemed to be sober enough for that era.
What was it about the 19th century that got everyone so interested in the idea of lunacy?
I think actually it goes back much further. I think it probably all kicked off in the 18th century. But what you do get in the 19th century is this increasingly urgent sense that insanity is something that must be treated humanely. And I see it as part of all of a piece with struggles for such things as the ending of the slave trade, the ending of child labour. And so, again, I can't overstress the role of evangelicals and low church people such as Quakers to bring a new humanitarianism into the treatment of the genuinely insane. What I haven't gone into a great deal in the book is the battle against cruelty. I didn't want to turn it into some really horrible voyeuristic gore fest, so I've tried to really background that. But what an awful lot of lunacy campaigning and legislation was about was to put an end to all forms of physical restraint and to start seeing therapeutically how can we cure those who are curable. And for those cases deemed to be chronic, which is the word they would use, and there they're talking about very, very large numbers of people with what we today call learning disabilities and of Alzheimer's cases. Those are the people who are not going to be improvable, if you like. They wanted to see what are the best conditions we can possibly do. And in that way, we'll separate ourselves off from the barbarities of the 18th century, from the barbarities of other countries who probably don't do it as well as Imperial England, which, of course, it was a bit of a joke. So that's what I think the 19th century obsession was. Also, it does have to be said, a large section of the mad doctor trade believed that increasing civilization, that's their word, not mine, was leading to the sort of mental instability of men. So there's nobody more refined than an Englishman in the 19th century. He's immensely cultivated. His brain has become very sophisticated. He's a successful businessman. He's a lovely father. And all of these strains are actually making male sanity very, very fragile. That was a belief. Not everybody agreed with it, but it was a... You do see this view repeated over and over again, that in fact it's the civilised nations that are facing this problem of a rising tide of lunacy. Exactly. A crisis of masculinity, a crisis of sanity. No one's ever been as civilised as the English ever in the history of the world. What is the secret price we're going to be paying? And the rising numbers of people who were being certified into mainly the county system indicated to many, oh dear, the English are in fact getting madder and madder, and we hadn't actually foreseen this as a price to pay for civilization.
Now, the way that you've constructed the book is to give a series of cases. How did you go about choosing which cases to write about? Because presumably you're looking at countless numbers.
I was spoilt for choice. And I could have written about maybe 20, 25. And what I wanted to do was make it much easier on the reader and whittle it down to the ones which each of the dozen or so that I have ended up with show a different aspect of lunacy thinking, lunacy law. So each of them is a bit like a prism. They each sort of bounce the light off in a different way. I wanted to avoid having, say, two or three stories that show the same thing over and over again, such as a wealthy businessman put away in order that an associate could grab his money, for example, or the wronged wife. There are three wronged wives in my book, but they're wronged in very different ways. And the diagnoses that are thrown at them are each very different. So I was very keen to avoid repetition, but to try and just get the full gamut of what you could have thrown at you in the 19th century if you were an eccentric man or an eccentric woman, and also very wealthy, that has to be said.
Of the cases that you ended up using in the book, perhaps we could end with you telling us which was the one that touched you the most, the one that you found the most affecting.
Well, funnily enough, it's the person who's possibly the least pleasant. Chapter 5, Mrs. Cumming, a very sort of aggressive, waspish old lady with money, very capricious, very spoilt. But there's something particularly revolting, I think, about elderly people being persecuted. There was no other word for what her daughters and her sons-in-law did to her in order to hurry up getting their mitts on their inheritance. 8 years of her having to move from house to house to house because they were determined that she was going to be put into an asylum so that they could gain total control of her estate. Literally her last breath, a mad doctor was asking her right up close, trying to make her say something that would prove that she was not right in the head. And her last breath, she died on Midsummer's Day 1853, she is trying to claim that she is sane. I have to say that one absolutely broke my heart.
Oh, doctor, I'm in trouble.
Well, goodness gracious me.
For every time a certain man is standing next to me, a flash comes to my face and my pulse begins to race. It goes boom, booty, 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 boom, 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 boom.
Sarah Wise on an era when sick people were shut away. Now we're all in it together. We can watch the most gruesome medical procedures on television, diagnose our own ailments on the internet, but medicine clearly requires an understanding of both the physical and the psychological. And it is this that the Wellcome Trust Book Prize has set out to encourage, with a prize that is open to both fiction and non-fiction. One of this year's judging panel is Brooke Magnanti, a scientist by training, who is best known as the author of A Cool Girl's Diary, Belle de Jour. I asked her to explain why she thinks the Wellcome Prize's range of subject and genre works.
Yeah, we were really happy with that because I think that there was a lot of discussion getting it down from the long list to the short list. And in the end, we were pretty well satisfied that there's a book on that list for everyone. You know, I was saying as I walked out, well, I know which book I'm going to recommend to my mother, and I know which book I'm going to recommend to my husband and to my friends and things like that. Which is good because I think that it's very unusual among literary prizes to have something that is open to both fiction and non-fiction. And I think the hope is really just to get as many people, as broad an audience, reading about medicine as possible.
Why do you think we're so interested in medicine? Why is there so, there are so many references to it in fiction these days, aren't there?
Yeah, I think part of it is maybe a little bit to do with just there's so much more information out there for us to process. You can't open a newspaper without seeing some kind of medical story, and people are very much more involved, I think, now with being concerned about medicine and about their health than they used to be. So, of course, there's this curiosity. And then as well, there's a curiosity about what happens behind the scenes, because to most people, it's very much a closed world. So the history of medicine comes up quite a lot as well.
Moving on to the shortlist itself, let's go through the non-fiction to start with. And one which is from a Wall Street trader turned neuroscientist. That's a very interesting career change, isn't it? Almost as interesting as yours. And this is The Hour Between Dog and Wolf by John Coates. Tell us about this.
This was an absolutely fascinating book because neuroscience is such a hot topic. We had a lot of books that were submitted that were about topics to do with neuroscience. But what this book did really brilliantly well was take a lot of those ideas and take a lot of the research that's out there and actually put it into a relatable context. So rather than just giving us anecdotes about research that's being performed, actually created a setting where we could see all of these various findings from neuroscience happening. And it puts into context one of the other big things that people are obsessed with at the moment, which is the financial crisis. Where did it come from? How did it start? What can we do about these things? And offers some really spectacular insights. I have to say, I felt like I'd learned a lot reading that book, but also really enjoyed it. It didn't feel like it was trying to, you know, bash any huge message down my throat.
It sounds almost like a Malcolm Gladwell sort of book.
In a lot of ways it is, but I would say that it's probably a bit more in-depth than a lot of Gladwell's writing because he is synthesizing research from so many different areas. You know, he's very, very multidisciplinary. And The Arrow Between Dog and Wolf is multidisciplinary in that there are two disciplines that are really focused on. But also the writer himself, he started out in finance and then went into science, which I think is something that's pretty unusual in anybody who's writing about these topics for the mainstream, is to have the actual background in the topics they're writing about.
Now, moving on to something completely different, The Train in the Night, which is a memoir from Nick Coleman. This is another big trope, if we say that the Malcolm Gladwell trope is one of the big things that's going on. This is the medical memoir is another trope in medical writing, isn't it?
It is, and we've seen it a lot with, the Oliver Sacks type books and all of the writing that's inspired. I think what Nick Coleman really brings to this shortlist is a very personal account of what it's like to go through a medical crisis. So his descriptions of what it feels like to actually lose your hearing are extraordinary. You wouldn't think that this is something that translates well to the written word, but he's done it, and in a way he has an advantage, having been a music journalist for a number of years, in being able to tell us what it sounds like, what the tinnitus sounds like, what just having everything distorted and turned off inside your own head sounds like. I've absolutely got this wonderful sense reading it of how passionate he is about music and what a massive loss this was. It wasn't just about losing the sense, but what the sense brought him and how that related to such of his life.
What he actually suffered from was sudden neurosensory hearing loss, wasn't it?
And he gives a lot of really fantastic anecdotes taking us through his history with music, and in a way that, he relates his own personal memories to what he was listening to, say, at the time that he went to meet the woman who became his wife for the first time. You know, what tape was in the cassette player in the car as he was driving to go see her and things like that. But he also brings out things that I'd never really noticed about the sound around us. Because, to be honest, I'm not really a musical person, so I don't really pay that much attention. And I felt like it really heightened my awareness, not only of the sounds around me, but just how fortunate we all are to be able to perceive them the way that we do.
So now the third non-fiction title is Thomas Wright's Circulation, which is a biography of William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of the blood. I'm very interested in the fact that it's a story of the Restoration, as is Rose Tremaine's Merivale, A Man of His Time.
Yeah, and the connections there were very interesting because, of course, they're two very different books in a lot of ways. With Circulation, we're looking at somebody's life from the outside. You know, there have been biographies of William Harvey before, but really nothing that's quite presented in the same way, nothing that really opens up the context and gives all the materials of what it's like to be in a room when a dissection is going on and the feel of it, the sound of it, the smell of it.
The arthritic, the apoplectic, the paralyzed, the pox-ridden, the jaundiced and the syphilitic were brought up one by one by the sisters, sometimes on stretchers, to the 31-year-old Harvey, who sat enthroned in the great hall in his purple cap and robes. Drawing close to the patient, Harvey would gain their confidence by his courteous manner, listening carefully as they described their ailment.
But this is all from the observer's point of view, and of course, Merivale is very much in the first person You know, so we have the experience of a doctor during the restoration, and indeed the doctor from restoration, and what it feels like for him to be doing the work that he does. How it feels to get older, see the people around him getting older. You know, when he performs a surgery on an old friend of his, for example, it's just an extraordinary scene. And I think as well, my concern when I read Marivelle was, is this going to be a book that is accessible for people who haven't read Restoration? But it does absolutely stand on its own. It's fantastic. Circulation is just such a complete work in itself. You really need know nothing about the history of medicine, or, you know, nothing about William Harvey, and really even not very much about human anatomy to really get something from this book. I thought it's, you know, in terms of giving the context of the discovery, it's right up there with Longitude. It's fantastic.
Marivelle, it's quite gory, isn't it? There are scenes of him operating on tumours and things.
Yeah, they don't hold back.
Do you think that there's an extent to which fiction can go where non-fiction can't?
I think that really with Marivelle, it's about the scene setting, because so much of what happens now, so much of what surgeons do now, it happens behind closed doors, and it really can be very brutal. And we have to remember, this is a time when, you know, the things like infection control and pain control and anesthesiology as we know it really didn't exist, which I think makes it much more immediate. And also when he recounts what it was like in the earlier book, in Restoration, when his daughter was born and having to perform a cesarean, an emergency cesarean, as opposed to now, where it's something that just gets scheduled in, you're taken into theatre, it all happens, and nobody really sits down and dissects the brutality of it, except, of course, for the people when they're rolled out in recovery, thinking, oh my God, that's a lot more painful than I thought it was going to be.
That's quite a good point, actually. So now let's move on to the contemporary stories. Mohammed Hanif, Our Lady of Alice Batty. Now, I was quite surprised to find this one on the list.
Yeah, because even though it takes place in a hospital and the main character is involved with nursing, it's really as much a political novel about, you know, the current state of that society as much as it is about medicine itself. And what I really liked about this is it opened up a society within a society. You know, the hospital is a kind of microcosm.
Within Pakistan?
Yes. And where you have all the various kind of levels that people interact with each other. In a lot of ways as well, it's also a very feminist novel in quite a lot of ways, because you have this extraordinarily strong, driven female lead character. You also get a sense of how people perceive her because of that and the difficulties that she experiences simply by being the way that she is, in a way that we might take for granted that a woman could be here.
And finally, Perfect People by Peter James. That's a bit of a Peter Piper, Pector Pepper, Pickled Peppers one, isn't it? Which is a thriller. Thriller writers actually are very forensic, aren't they, in their researches, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think what this brought together was, you know, quite a lot about genetic science and people's fears about that. You know, we do know a lot in terms of having decoded the human genome and this gene leads to that outcome and things like that. Although we're discovering more all the time, obviously, because the so-called junk DNA is now being opened up and telling us much more about how coding leads to proteins, how proteins lead to outcomes. But what Perfect People does is really explores this notion, this fear that people have of, would it be a good thing or a bad thing to be able to choose exactly what your child is going to be like? How much do we not know about what we think that we know? So obviously you have these parents who initially have a child who dies very young from a genetic disease, and obviously they're concerned. They want to continue to have a family, but know that the statistics are not in their favor, so they go to a doctor who can help them out. And it's the sort of situation that I think a lot of people could imagine themselves in. And the ethical questions that opens up as soon as you start to do that, these are things that have been explored in a lot of other books, you know, very popular books like My Sister's Keeper and things like that. But what Perfect People does is takes those notions and puts them just a little bit in the future, just a little bit beyond what our capabilities are now, but not in a world that's unrecognizable to us. So it's a little bit like a future dystopia, but it's actually not that far in the future. It's a future we could actually imagine, that we could actually end up in shortly.
Sarah Wise's Inconvenient People is published by Bodley Head, and the Wellcome Prize winner will be announced on Wednesday, November the 7th. If all this medical detail's a bit much for you, you can take solace in The Guardian's review, which will feature an Alice Munro short story on Saturday, or in The Observer's new review, which will be announcing the winner of the Observer Jonathan Cape Graphic Short Story Prize. And before I go, can I encourage you to become regular subscribers, either through iTunes podcasts, search for The Guardian page, or through our website at guardian.co.uk/books. Just click on the tab at the top of the site. And do remember to let us know what you think or what you'd like us to cover in future. We'll be back next week. But for now, thanks to Thomas Keneally, Sarah Wise, Sarah Crown and Brooke Magnanti. From me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.